Progressive Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Sylvia Stoltz, that great German freedom fighter whose last name means proud, is about to be released from prison. This will take place on April 14th, or maybe April 13th, but when it does, it will be 3 years and 3 months after her arrest for doing her job as a defense attorney for Ernst Zundel. It is said that during the trial, she called the Holocaust the biggest lie in world history. Well, that's what we call truth-telling, but that's also from a third-party translation, so what is it that she really said? In any event, Ernst was released from 7 years in prison last year, but he still doesn't have full freedom, even though he was not given any kind of early release or he's not on probation. Now, Germar Rudolf is also having difficulty establishing a normal life again because of restrictions placed on him. This is the German legal system, quote, unquote. But it can't all be blamed on Germany because Germany is still a U.S.-occupied country, and the United States is also making it difficult for both Germar Rudolf and Ernst Zundel to return here, where they both have wives who are U.S. citizens. Now, I wonder why foreign nationals can flood across our southern border from Mexico and point south, but these two law-abiding men with proper paperwork cannot be allowed in. Well, I won't say any more about that because I don't know what all the legal ramifications are, and I don't want to make things worse. But I'm sure most of you listening are cheering along with me that our heroic survivor, Sylvia Stoltz, Sylvia the Proud, will be back among the active and living once again. I've asked Gunter Decker to come on the program right after Sylvia's release, as he lives near to that prison fortress in Mannheim. And in fact, he showed it to me when I was there in his area about a year and a half ago or more, and where Sylvia has been kept, and he's going to be there among those who are gathered to greet her when she's released. So we'll hear all about that when the time comes. Now that brings me to something else I'd like to mention. Some of my listeners ask me from time to time to have some known revisionists as guests. Yes, I would like to, and I have asked many of them, but for a variety of reasons, they declined. And it is for a variety of reasons. It's not just fear of legal reprisal. This type of revisionist seems to be, they seem to be shy people, or they don't like to get out in the public eye that much. In any case, I have not had that good of luck, although some promised me maybe at a later time. So I want you to know that I'm always looking, and I'm working to bring you the very best guests I can, people with something new and important to say. And so tonight, I'm very pleased to introduce you to a new face here, a guest of this type, whose name is Mr. Hans Krampe, and I may not be pronouncing that last name right. He's coming to us from the Radical Press in British Columbia, Canada. You remember that Arthur Topham was my guest on my fifth program about a year ago in March 2010, and Hans has been writing for the Radical Press for quite a few years, and back when it was a print paper, even. And he has just recently published a great article titled Donuts and the American Brass. Donuts meaning that great admiral, head of the naval staff in the Third Reich, Admiral Karl Donuts. I asked Hans to join me to talk about this article, but before we do that, we're going to talk about Hans's very interesting life story. We may need two programs to cover that, to cover everything we want to talk about, and so we will do that if necessary. So, welcome, Hans.
Welcome. Hi, Carolyn.
Sorry I made you wait so long, Hans. But I did want to cover that Sylvia Stoltz material. But I'm very happy to have you. And I'd like you to begin by just telling our listeners where and when you were born and what you remember about your early years. And while you're at it, please give your name so that we know how it's properly pronounced.
Well, you pronounced that perfectly, Hans Krampe.
Oh.
And, well, family lore has it that I was born during an Allied air raid in the center, in the city center of the Berlin, which was the capital of Germany at the time. And a bomb was going off, and that's when I popped out and saw the light of day. And so I can say I came on this earth with a big bang. Well, I don't, the first thing that I remember was that I was living at my grandmother's away from Berlin in the direction of Hamburg, a small village called Gardelegen. That's where I spent my first 2 or 3 years. That got me out of harm's way, and, you know, Gardelegen was never bombed. And after 3 years, my mom had married and established a place in a small town, actually a town with a history, about 20 kilometers from Berlin, about 40 kilometers from city center of Berlin. The name of the town was Nauen. And Nauen was, before and during the Second World War, the most powerful radio station in the world. You could hear the Nauen time signal all around the earth. That was something unmatched at the time. Well, the Soviets came and dismantled everything and took it to the Soviet Union. I still remember convoys of Russian army going up and down the main street through Nauen, and tanks roaring around, and Soviets pitching a camp somewhere in the fields. But by that time, when I became aware of them, nobody was scared of them anymore. You know, they were just taken as a fact of life.
And now what year would this be?
That would be in the late 40s, you know, 46, 47, 48, until the 50s.
Okay, now I have written down here that it was in 1949 that the Soviet zone was established. You were in the Soviet zone.
Yeah. Well, I think the Soviet zone was established as a response to West Germany, where the Americans, the British, and the French had formed a common front. I think that was also the beginning of the Cold War. And,
yes,
you know, the Russians weren't friends with their former allies anymore, and lines were drawn. And it so happened that my family wound up in the DDR, the German Democratic Republic, which was then administered under the administration of the Russians. By 1949 or 1950, 1949, I think, I started to go to school. Now, in hindsight, I can say that, you know, right from the outset, brainwashing set in with Bolshevist propaganda. For example, instead of talking about Santa Claus, we were talking about Father Frost, and we were talking about the Soviet mascot, Misha the Bear, and we were talking about the great Father Stalin, who was the friend of all children. And that kind of thing, you know. We were encouraged to join the young pioneers and to make
Was
it,
there any, what about religion? I mean, that was just stayed away from? I mean, we weren't in a religious school, but I mean, was it just kind of ignored?
Now in hindsight, I remember that religion was discouraged, maybe even outlawed or what, something like that. But my mom hated the communists and they loved the Nazis, and so she was anathema, because to love the Nazis was so politically incorrect. You didn't talk about this, you know.
Oh, I can't imagine. She didn't say that out loud, did she?
Or yes.
How did that work? Oh, she did.
My mom wasn't very prudent in that respect. Well, years later, it had the effect that my father had to leave East Germany and move to the West, and we had to all escape from East Germany and move to the West, because my father worked in a higher position in trade, and there was a trade organization, a communist trade organization called Konsum, and he was working as one of the three heads of a supply depot for the Konsum. So he was in an influential position, and of course he was under intense scrutiny of what he would do and what he was thinking and saying. So eventually my mother caused so much trouble that we all had to leave.
Okay. Did you have siblings?
Yes, I have a sister. She lives still in Germany.
Okay, is she older than you, or?
She is 6 years younger.
Okay.
You know, when all this took place, she wasn't born yet.
Yes.
Then school carried on, and I remember in the second and third grade, instead of learning reading and writing and history, we were told stories from the Soviet Union and how the Soviet Union was so industrially advanced that they had big trucks with big tires, and we little kids sat there just in awe. And
They didn't teach you to read and write?
Well, yeah, but I remember hours were spent just listening to these fairy tales. They were told with great skill. They had us all captivated and just relieved that we didn't have to write and read, you know, and strain our brains. We were just sitting there listening and soaking it all up. And they were also talking about the bad Nazis, of course. I mean, the horror that they were telling us was so bad. We were just glad we had survived it, and now the Russian friends were there and protecting us and showing us the right way, you know.
Yes. Well, now, how did you correlate this with your mother? I could see this being something of a conflict for you.
Oh, well, yeah, it was a conflict. You know, like, mm-hmm. I was kind of very skeptical about the opinions of my mother. But that was only, you know, in the background, kind of superficial. It wasn't a major thing. I mean, I was just a kid, you know. I wasn't in the position to, or didn't even want, or being capable of making, you know, judgment calls, you know, judging my mom. I just thought that was a kind of thing of politics, and I didn't know anything about it, and that was something for the grown-ups. Anyway, in 1953, I think in March, Stalin died, and
yes.
I was still living in East Germany, and a world collapsed for me. Stalin, the great father and friend of the children, had passed away. How can we go on living? It was, that went through my head.
And now, you would have been like 9 years old, about.
Yeah, 8 years. Yeah.
8 years old. I want to bring up something here that in 1953, when he died, in 1952, thinking about that for your age. In 1952, there was something called the Stalin Note, and he was proposing German reunification and superpower disengagement from Central Europe, which the three Allied governments, U.S., France, and the United Kingdom, rejected. Now, what was going on with that?
Oh, I can only speculate about that because I know nothing about it, really. But knowing now that I have, that I'm a little bit more enlightened about the history of the what went on before. For example, the Stalin-Ribbentrop pact was something similar, where Stalin entered into the act pretending a non-aggression pact, you know, a friendship pact almost, and using the time he gained from that to move huge amounts of military personnel and arms to his western border in preparation to invade Europe. Something to the tune of over 200 divisions or something, which was later confirmed by Vladimir Rezun, who wrote the book Icebreaker. It may very well have been another one of those Stalin tricks to get Germany wide open and defenseless, and for him then to introduce what the Bolshevists had done in the 20s and in during the First World War already, where they moved in all kinds of Bolshevist activists, and then slowly with propaganda and sabotage and all kinds of mischief got control over the unions in Germany, and suddenly they were standing there with 6 million union members being part of the Communist Party and now converting certain regions of Germany into German Soviets under the control of Moscow via these guys, via these heads who were these leaders who were leading the communist movement in Germany. You talked about Jews, and I'm talking about Jews, and they were all Jews. The leadership of the communist movement in Germany was entirely staffed by Jews and run by Jews and driven by Jews.
Well, what about the leadership of the Communist Party in East Germany? They called the SED. Was that still run by Jews when East Germany was in effect and the Soviet Union was kind of was in control of that, actually?
Those Germans. Those Germans were Germans that had been communist members from way back, from the Russian Revolution, from 1917 on, and they had been trained and indoctrinated in Moscow, and they now became the East German leadership on behalf of Moscow, and they were staunch supporters of Moscow and Stalin and all that.
Yes, okay, and, that's what I thought. They weren't really Jews then. But,
no,
these German communists, what would you have to say about German communists going back like that? What kind of Germans were they anyway?
Well, they were very nice to kids as part of the denazification program. You had to be nice to the kids. You know, these guys came across as the friends of kids, and the kids loved them. You know, for me, I thought these are really nice people, so I want to support them. You know, and I want to be friends with them. So I joined the Young Pioneer, and I got a nice blue bandana that were tied with a special knot around my neck, with a little needle with a sign on it, Young Pioneers, with flames coming out. It looked real cool. And I came home. It lasted for about a day, and I came home, and my mom told me, you bring this bandana back right away, tomorrow. And me crying and whining, and I want to keep this banana anyway. My mom didn't like to see something like that. That was about the time, you know, the late 40s, 47, 48. There were many things you couldn't get in East Germany in terms of food, like luxury items like coffee. You couldn't get nylon stockings. You couldn't get chocolate. You couldn't get citrus fruits. And so my mom, we had a relative a grand aunt of my father's aunt, who was a tailor master in West Berlin. And in those days, the border between West Berlin and East Germany was still open because hundreds of thousands of East Germans from the outskirts of Berlin went across this border into Berlin to work into the Siemens works, to work into the Borsig works, earning Westmark, being able to go and shop West products, and then go back to East Germany and providing this valuable West currency as a foreign currency reserve for the East Germans, because the East German mark was worth nothing, very little. You know, like for something like 2 East German marks, you got something like 25 cents West or something like that. So in those days, my mom went and worked for my aunt, you know, cleaning up the shop and the flat and washed laundry and did the laundry and all that. And my aunt gave my mom heaps of oranges, lemon, chocolate, coffee, nylon stockings, all kinds of stuff, you know, cigarettes, and lots of West money too. And then we would go back, and this would happen on the weekends, kind of. Every weekend we would go and see my aunt.
These are the blessings of family, right? Your family is always going to help you out.
Yeah. So we always traveled by steam train. Everything was run by steam locomotives, and I was a steam locomotive fan. I would stand there and watch steam locomotives until the cows come home, and I would be in ecstasy just watching these and listening to the sound. Anyway, it was always a great adventure for me. Every weekend there was an adventure traveling to West Berlin and then going through the control spot.
Customs or whatever?
No, these were Volkspolizei. They were, police, armed police, kind of like a militia, semi-military, standing there with machine pistols and looking bored and letting everybody go through this way and coming back that way, and nobody would be ever stopped or checked for his passport or anything. So it was easy. The border was open and people went to work in the West, and so did my mom. So by 1953, it was decided that I should spend my education in West Berlin staying at my grand aunt's. And so I moved to West Berlin, but my family still stayed in Nauen. And I went to boarding school because I would then introduce into boarding school because my grand aunt was just too busy. She couldn't take care of me. She was a widow and all by herself, and she was always busy, always working every day. Sunday she would sit there and make cuttings for the next week for the girls to sew and this kind of thing. To Easter and during the summer holidays and Christmas and these kinds of things, I would travel home and stay with my family. And those were very enjoyable years for me. And when in 1953 Stalin died, I was still living in East Germany, in Nauen. But right after that, I think in May or so, I moved to West Berlin to my aunt's place. And I remember reading in the Stern magazine, Stern meaning Star magazine, seeing all these pictures of the Russian tanks moving in and the people throwing Molotov cocktails at these tanks, and there were shots fired, and I thought, Jesus, what's going on here? You know, this is like a war going on. And of course, the drift of the reporting was, of course, anti-Soviet and pro-Western, and perfect opportunity to criticize the Russians, you know, being again the big villains. Well, I must say, at that time, I still was very much indoctrinated with the spirit of East Germany. East Germany seemed to me a safe haven, while the West seemed to be something hostile and aggressive.
Okay, well, you know what, Hans? We're going to have to take, I have to cut in here. We're going to have to take our break now. And so let's remember, when we come back from the news break, we'll start right back in what this story was all about. Mm-hmm. Stick with us, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Let's get more analysis on the situation in Libya. We're joined by John Loughlin from the Institute of Democracy and Cooperation in Paris. Now, the British Foreign Secretary has said that there will be no occupation forces in Libya, although earlier he refused to rule out ground operations. How far do you think the coalition could go?
I think when he says that, he's probably speaking the truth. After all, the United Nations Security Council resolution itself ruled out any ground forces or any foreign occupation of Libya. And I'm sure it isn't in the plans of the Allies to have such a ground force or occupation. I think that they think, to the extent that they have thought about this at all, that the matter can be settled with an air campaign. However, I think they're gravely mistaken. And I think that this escapade will end in catastrophic failure, precisely because they have decided to restrict themselves to an air campaign. Let's not forget that the same policy was taken by Hillary Clinton's husband, Bill Clinton, over Kosovo when NATO decided to attack Yugoslavia in 1999. That war was only an air campaign, and the original idea of that war was to bomb Serbia for a few days to bring Slobodan Milosevic to heel. The campaign ended up lasting 74 days, and my conviction, in fact, is that the European leaders and the Americans who have pushed this attack on Libya have committed the same mistake. In other words, they think that a quick bit of bombing will sort the matter out. But in fact, I think they will find that it will last far longer than they've gambled for.
Now, that air campaign, nevertheless, has been seriously criticized by Russia, which follows the Arab League criticizing the campaign, saying that it's gone way beyond what they had backed originally, causing civilian deaths. Do you think that coalition forces will take on board this growing criticism that we're hearing from around the world?
No, I don't think they will, but unfortunately it will, of course, be a major factor in the sense that it will undermine their ability to prosecute the war in the way they want. But no, I'm afraid I think that these people who are, and I'm talking about the British Prime Minister, the French President, the American administration, these people who are so happy to let bombs fly on countries that almost at the drop of a hat, they are determined to get the outcome they want, which is the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. So it will make the task, the disagreements and the discordant voices that are now coming out both within Western states and also, as you say, in the Arab League, these will indeed make it very difficult to continue the war, but I'm afraid they won't let go now that they've started.
Now, there also appears to be splits within the coalition over whether or not Colonel Gaddafi himself is a target. Do you think that there are kind of different interests here between the coalition forces and that perhaps...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I'm here with my guest, Hans Krampe. He has been telling us about his childhood and his school years in East Germany from 1943 on. We're up now into around 1953. And Hans, you were just telling us about this attack on the East German people who were sort of putting up an uprising against the Soviet system. And they were being, the tanks were rolling in, and so on. So continue with that.
Well, what the reason was for the, or what brought this all on was that the Russians were skimming off the top of the products, of the productivity of the East German industry, and suppressing the wages of the workers. At the same time, they demanded higher and higher quotas. Well, you got to realize, especially the coal miners were working on a bonus system, and they were depending for the income on the bonus, which gave them a reasonable kind of income. But then the German government, on behalf of the Soviet Union, started to increase more and more the quotas that they had to produce in order to be eligible for the bonuses. And it became so bad that the Germans eventually couldn't keep up with it. Here's what the German government actually did, the East German government. They had an athlete by the name of Henneke training for a month intensively and giving him excellent food, and then sending him underground for 24 hours, working his butt off. And then they would say, well, if Henneke can do it, everybody can do it. Now you, this is the new quota, you have to work up to this quota. Well, nobody could keep up with that. So it came down to the point where nobody would get his bonus anymore. The income that was left then was so little that nobody could make a decent living anymore. People started actually to go hungry. And that is when people started to protest.
Well, that's really not very smart, is it? You know, you wonder why they would do a thing like that.
Well, politicians say they are not
very smart.
Yeah,
well, you know, what I say, that's communist rule is like Jewish rule. And what we see happening under communist rule is what we will always find also what we can expect under Jewish rule. Even if the communists aren't all Jews or aren't Jews at the time.
Well, it's Jewish inspired anyway, and mm-hmm. I agree with you there. It's practically the way Jews operate.
You can't get enough. Just keep trying to get more and more and more.
Well, they are predators, yeah. And that's how predators mm-hmm. operate. They suck out the lifeblood of the host until the host dies, and then they just move on to the next host. And well, once they were finished with Germany, or they aren't even finished with Germany, it's mm-hmm. still going on. Then, but by that time, they had already started on America, you know, and they are doing with the United States and Canada the same thing.
Well, one thing that struck me was that they had, in this particular uprising, they jailed 10,000 people. Now, you know, so many times people will say, and I'm among them, well, if we get a few thousand people to go out and protest, they can't put us all in jail. But in this case, they put 10,000 in jail, and they managed to do it.
Although it was more than that. You remember the concentration camp Sachsenhausen? Sachsenhausen was not far from Berlin. And after the war, under the administration of the Russians, they were using it as a concentration camp for themselves. Mm-hmm. And they, word has it, or the evidence indicates that the Russians murdered over 50,000 people in Sachsenhausen after the war.
They were
not just 10,000 incarcerated, probably there were 10,000 incarcerated, but in Sachsenhausen, 50,000 were murdered, and they were probably simply because they were Germans or because they were opposed to Soviet rule, or they had been loyal to the National Socialist government of the Third Reich, something like that.
Yeah.
And so anyway, the exploitation of East Germany, the rampant exploitation of East Germany by the Soviet Union after having dismantled all the industry that was dismantlable, and went so extreme that Germans went onto the street, and the East German government called in Russian tank divisions to deal with the protests. And it went on for something like 3 days, and many people got killed, and eventually the riot was subdued. But remember this, this was the first uprising in the Eastern Bloc against the Soviet Union. As a consequence of that, there followed uprisings in Poland, uprisings in Czechoslovakia, uprisings in Hungary. All these happened shortly afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, 56, 58, and in
Czechoslovakia,
etc. So, but it didn't affect me, and it didn't affect my family, because my family didn't live in Berlin, and there was, you know, it lived in a little town, and West Berlin, there was no effect on that, on West Berlin, and I only experienced that through the newspapers and the magazines. Well, by 1960, my schooling was finished. I never went to the elevated education system like high school or what was called real school, Realschule, which mm-hmm. was Realschule, that level of education you needed if you wanted to become an engineer or an architect or something like that. Gymnasium, which is the equivalent of high school, that education you needed for academic levels, you know, doctor, lawyer, that kind of thing. I never went so far. I went to the practical level of education and started to be able to start an apprenticeship. Well, by that time, my father had moved to West Germany, and my mom and my sister had moved to West Germany, and they lived in the Ruhr area, which is the industrial heartland of Germany. You know, there are the cities of Solingen, Cologne, Essen, Düsseldorf, mm-hmm. Dortmund, etc.
And that's on the far west part of Germany.
That's east of the Rhine River. You know, mm-hmm. that area, yes. East of the Rhine River. And what they mainly produced was coal, and there were huge steel mills because coal was there, and lots of industry. You know, the Solingen knives and the Solingen scissors, etc. And so I joined my parents in the city of Velbert, in the heart of the heartland of industry, and began an apprenticeship as a tool and die maker. And that went on for about 3.5 years, and I passed my exams. And during the apprenticeship, I realized tool and die making is not really my beef. You know, I would like to do something else, but now that I had started it, I was not going to quit. I was going to finish it, and then I would do something else. Well, I was 19 when I was finished, and 19 and a half years came around, and I joined the Navy.
Well, so, can I ask you, and maybe you're going to get to this, but how were your feelings between East and West Germany and between communism and what's called democracy at that time, from shifting over to the West? Did you just not think about it very much, or did you have a lot of thoughts about it?
Well, I had feelings about it. I didn't think much at the time. I missed East Germany. You know, I felt homesick to it. It was where I grew up as a kid during my formative years. And that is not something that you just can shrug off. There were lots of good things in East Germany that, for me as a kid, was great. There wasn't that much industry popping up everywhere. You had lots of agriculture going on, very little construction, at least not in the countryside and in small towns. For a kid, that was like paradise. We could run around in the fields. There were trails, you know, the tracks in the fields that were used by the farmers that were bordered by fruit trees that grew wild. Anybody could go there and grab themselves beautiful wild fruits that tasted like a million bucks. And the clean air.
What about the people? Did you find a difference in the people?
Yes, definitely. Later on, I used to travel several times to East Germany while I was already living and established in West Germany. And it was like day and night. The East German people were much more hospitable and warm-hearted. Like they were not so career and materialistic oriented. In East Germany, everybody was more relaxed, no stress, not much income, no high standard of living. But I think in general, you know, people were more content and peaceful. In German society, West German society was much more aggressive than the East Germans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It would be, and capitalistic.
Yeah, capitalistic.
Yes.
And
that's very interesting. But I've heard many people say that. That's why so many Russians have nostalgic feelings for communist days.
When the war came down, in the initial phase, lots of East Germans just flocked into the West and went shopping and thought, this is now freedom, and now we're going to get affluent and get all the stuff that we only dreamed about and could never get, and da 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 da. So they did. But it didn't take long for them to really see what the score was with the West. And even today, you will find lots of East German talking about East Germany with a sense of nostalgia of the good old days, you know, when things were more slow and more less stressful and more calm and peaceful.
Well, yeah, and so many things were provided, which people do tend to like. Housing and medical care and
free Medicare, free education, you know. Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have to worry about those things.
For 25 cents, you could travel all over the city of Berlin because the transportation system of Berlin was, half of it was run by East Germany, you know, like the elevated electric trains and the subways. I think they were both run by East Germany.
But you know, Hans, those systems always end up going broke. I mean, they really don't support themselves in the long run.
I don't think so. I think it depends. Well, here we come in the most important issue of the Second World War. Adolf Hitler's attempts, or actually his success in achieving financial sovereignty for the German Reich by getting public control over the stock markets and banking. And when you get control over the stock markets and banking and the creation of the money supply, you don't have to pay interest. And interest-free currency was the reason why Germany suddenly experienced such a boom during the Third Reich. I mean, the National Socialist Germany was the only nation on earth who got out of a deep depression, almost total bankruptcy and oblivion. Within a couple of years, there was no more unemployment, and within 4 years, there was overemployment, there was a boom.
Yes, that's true. Let me break in here for just a second. Well, in the Soviet Union and say in communist East Germany, were they free of the international banking system and the usury system, or are they still in that system?
I'm not sure about that. I think that the Soviet Union maintained a sovereign kind of monetary policy. And so did the East Bloc countries then, who were tied into the Soviet economy and the financial system. But the difference was the leadership. You had an elite pursuing essentially capitalist ideals in a certain way, in terms of classes. While they were on the one hand fighting a class war, on the other hand, they created a class for themselves and became the elite. who then existed at the expense of the lower classes. Well, which is in effect a capitalist system.
Yes.
It didn't call itself that way, but that's what...
That's what I'm getting at. So, yeah. So we don't want to confuse our listeners.
No. It's rather, you know, there can be a lot talked about on that issue. We wouldn't want to get into that because I'm not all that familiar with that either, although I have learned quite a bit about it. Mm-hmm. So there was a difference in the mentality that evolved since 1945 between the East Germans and the West Germans. In the West, increasingly, you got the rat race, you got, you know, the striving for status, for possessions, for making money, getting rich, that kind of thing. And East Germany had, the majority of East Germans, I think, had given up on that and just tried to get along as best as they could with what was there.
So then you joined you decided to join the Navy.
No, well, there came 1961. What was it, 1961 when Kennedy was assassinated?
When 63. Was that?
63. Kennedy got into government in the United States. And I saw a lot of pictures about Kennedy, and I read, you know, articles about him in the papers, and the emotional impression I got from Kennedy was, here is a guy who is well-meaning, who is strong, who has good intentions, things will change for the better. The general sense was, as long as we got Kennedy there, things would get better in all the world, you know, especially in the countries that were aligned with the United States. Well, then in 1963, this is, you know, 3 years into my apprenticeship, or actually the fourth year, Kennedy was assassinated, and it was like, bang, here we are back into the abyss again. You know, things as, I wonder what's going to happen now. I saw pictures of Lyndon B. Johnson, and to be honest, the pictures I saw, just watching, seeing the pictures of Lyndon B. Johnson, I thought, that guy is a crook. You know, that guy is not well-meaning. I have my worries about what's coming next, you know, with him in power. And why was he there right away to get sworn in? Etc. Oh yeah, well, he was the vice president or something like that. And later history bore that out. You know, the Vietnam War was intensified, and then Nixon got into power and all that. Anyway, by the end of 1963, my apprenticeship was finished, and in January 1964, I joined the Navy. I did my boot camp training, and then following the boot camp, I got to Naval Communication School and learned to be a radio operator, doing flashlight communication and semaphore communication and D&M coding and learning English. But my English was very poor at the time. I mean, just a few words that I knew, and only restricted to the very basic and crude kind of things you had to know in order to radio telephone communication between ships and signal stations, etc. My first journey into a foreign country was England, in order to pick up on my English knowledge by being forced to apply it in real life. I took a holiday from the Navy of 7 weeks, and I went to Edinburgh, Scotland, and during that time I learned to think in English. When I came back from Scotland, my English knowledge had vastly improved.
All right, Hans, we're running out of time, so in order to get to where we want to get to before the end of the program, let me ask you to tell us how you got to a point of being woken up and to where you are today, because you had told me that it wasn't until like around 1998 or so that you realized that you had been somewhat brainwashed all your life?
Well, the waking up to my brainwashing actually happened here in Canada with the emergence of the internet and with me having a computer, and all of a sudden all this information was at your fingertips that showed an entirely different version of history that I was used to. And at first I thought, well, what the hell is this? But then after a while I realized, well, yeah, the entire history that I have learned was looked at from a negative point of view. The Nazis were bad, the National Socialism was bad, Hitler was evil, and I thought, well, I'm looking for anyone who actually has something good to say about the Nazi, about the Third Reich, about Hitler. And I made it my job to look at history from a positive point of view. And lo and behold, I found all kinds of truth that way.
How did you get is that where you found Arthur Topham, by just on the internet?
Well, that was connected to developments here in British Columbia and Canada in general. That started in 1983 with the arrival of Prime Minister Mulroney, who then began to dismantle all the public crown corporations that had served Canadians all so well for decades. They were all suddenly dismantled by privatization. And that didn't agree with me and many other people at all. What made me to become more politically engaged in my attitude was that nobody seems to buck. There were people just whining about it, but nobody would do anything about it. And then what became even more irritating was that once Mulroney was finished with his terms, he was making millions of bucks, you know, in jobs that were provided with him as a reward for his treason on Canada by walking around and giving speeches, you know, like $100,000 speeches and representing this and that and the other. You know how it goes. Once you leave, all of a sudden there's...
Well, when did you start writing?
Well, that was in 1998 when Arthur asked me to join him to publish the Radical newspaper. Just before that, I had been writing letters to the editor, and many of my letters wouldn't get published because they were too controversial, you know, or too right wing.
Know about that.
So Arthur seemed to have the same problem on many topics, and so Arthur decided, let's start our own newspaper and publish there our views.
Oh, so you were right there on the ground floor with that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know
yeah.
that. Well, what would you say? Now, we're going to have to close for today, Hans, and I want you to come back next week. But what would you say, how would you describe your politics today? Are you able to describe it? What would you say you are politically?
To put it in a nutshell, I'm a national socialist. I like to live in a nation, and I like to have social programs.
You've come all the way around to your mother's point of view, haven't you?
Yeah. Occasionally I talk to my mom and I tell her, Mom, I have seen the light. And my mom is now 96 years old, 93.
Oh.
And she doesn't know what to say. That is so far behind her now, she forgot all about it.
Oh. Is she still in Germany?
Yes, she lives still in Fairbert in Germany.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Well, Hans, I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Will that be all right with you?
Sure, Caroline. Until next time, then.
All right, then. Good night, everyone. Thank you for listening, and please do come back again next week.
Thanks. Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.